Iran strongly condemns adoption of U.S.-backed resolution to remove the country from the UN's Women Commission as politically motivated and against the UN Charter. The Hamas leader in Gaza says resistance is the only way to liberate occupied territories as Palestinians mark the 35th anniversary of the creation of the resistance movement. And the Kremlin says Patriot missile defense systems would be a legitimate target for Russian strikes should the U.S. authorize their delivery to Ukraine. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. Iran has strongly condemned the adoption of U.S.-backed resolution by the UN Economic and Social Council to remove the Islamic Republic from the Commission of the Status of Women. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani described the move as politically motivated and illegitimate. He said the resolution also contravened the UN Charter and set a wrong precedent in the international body. Kanani added, through this hostile move, the U.S. intends to impose its unilateral political demands on international organizations. The spokesman said it is ironic, despite all its crimes against Palestinians, Israel is still a member of the Commission of the Status of Women. He noted the U.S. has been extensively violating the rights of Iranian women through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and is in no position to advocate their rights.
The streets in front of the United Nations office in Tehran once again became the scene of peaceful protests. This time, a group of Iranian activists and students gathered to condemn an attempt by several Western governments to remove Iran from the Commission on the Status of Women, or CSW, over what they call the Iranian government's violations of women's rights and crackdown on protests.
We are here on behalf of all women who are deprived of education and a normal life to say that Islam guarantees the rights of women and gives them freedom.
Because it is with hijab where we can come out, express our identity, express our personality.
According to a statement by the protesters, the Commission on the Status of Women has never questioned its members for violating women's rights, but now it has suddenly become a supporter of Iranian women's rights.
Eliminating Iran from the UN Women's Commission doesn't make us upset, because the record of this commission is full of contradictions, and its silence regarding the situation of women in certain member states raises a lot of questions.
Basically, they are protesting the hypocrisy that is taking place. It's ironic that the countries that are really leading this charge, United States, France, England, and we see the reality that is taking place inside of these countries. So on the one hand, we have so much hypocrisy, because we know at the very beginning of how this started, that one woman all of a sudden got the attention of the world. And we know, especially myself, as an American, as a black American, that women in general are not that important for them.
The protesters' main concern is the fact that Western diplomats and rights activists have attempted to remove Iran from the CSW, while international institutions have been pursuing a contradictory approach on women's rights for years, and women have time and again fallen victim to political schemes.
The demonstrators have gathered here in the capital, Tehran, to send a message that they are the true face of Iranian women. They're also demanding the United Nations to remain impartial despite pressure from certain countries. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Iran's southwestern Abadan refinery is the oldest oil refinery in the country. Plant has embarked on a mega project aimed at modernizing its deteriorating equipment. Yusuf Jalali reports from the city of Abadan.
The first oil refinery in the Middle East, located in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, near the western coast of the Persian Gulf, the Abadan refinery was launched in 1912. However, due to the deterioration of its old plants, it has undergone fundamental renovation since 2005, aiming to optimize the quality of its products and stabilize its processing capacity at 360,000 barrels per day.
We renew or establish some new refinery in two parts. One part with 150,000 barrels per day in more than 15 years ago. Now we established the new phase one with 210,000 barrels. The sum of the phase one and two is 360,000 barrels per day as a new capacity and the new refinery.
The second renovation phase, with a capacity of 210,000 barrels per day, needs 2.6 billion euros to be accomplished. But due to the Western sanctions, the project's financial resources face challenges.
Because of sanctions, we cannot follow, we cannot get the full finance. This finance is break to half the finance or the investment of this project, more than 1 billion euro up to now. And in the future, in the next year, we start the phase two or section two of this project to complete the refinery.
All of the products at the new phase of the Abadan refinery will be produced with a Euro 5 standard, which makes them more eco-friendly.
With the environmental aspects, sulfur recovery more than 460,000 tons per day as the capacity of the sulfur unit to remove all pollution from the oil and products of this refinery.
Phase 2 of the Abadan refinery will include the construction of hydrogen production units, hydrocrackers, a liquefied petroleum gas distillation unit, and ancillary facilities.
Authorities say once the project comes on stream, the Abadan refinery will turn into an energy hub in the country by 2025. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Abadan.
The Iranian parliament has condemned Western sanctions on Iran's English-language news channel Press TV and subsequent decision of Europe's satellite operator Eutelsat to take it off the air. In a statement, the Iranian lawmaker said the EU measures that led to the satellite blackout are a clear example of the violation of freedom of expression, stressing action is politically motivated and based on false accusations. According to the statement, the move is aimed at silencing any voice that reflects the truth and opposes the views of mainstream media, but it emphasized Press TV will continue its work and remain the voice of the voiceless. Last week, France-based Eutelsat notified Press TV that it will cease its transmission in line with sanctions. Now, recently, EU imposed sanctions on 29 Iranian individuals and three organizations, including Press TV, over Iran's response to recent riots in the country. Head of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Gaza says resistance is the only way to liberate the occupied Palestinian lands. In a speech marking the 35th anniversary of the movement's creation, Yahya Sinwar condemned the regime's aggressive policies against Palestinians, stressing the resistance front will continue to fight against those atrocities, but called for unity among Palestinians. Sinwar also slammed some Arab nations for normalizing ties with what he called the apartheid regime. The Hamas political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, also spoke on the occasion and emphasized the movement's unwavering support for and commitment to the Palestinian cause. Hamas was established soon after the first Palestinian uprising broke out against Israeli occupation. Movement has been administering Gaza since 2007 when it scored a surprise parliamentary victory. Every year, Hamas marks the anniversary of its foundation with military parades and rallies.
In a mass rally and under a sea of green flags, men and women from all walks of life came out to take part in Hamas's 35th anniversary celebration. Hamas, who was founded in 1987, won the Palestinian parliamentary elections in January 2006, but remains blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime. The movement has fought several wars against the Israeli regime since 2007. The resistance movement said that Al-Quds is at the center of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Hamas asserts today that Al-Quds is at the core of our struggle against the Israeli occupation. We're also sending a message of Palestinian unity. As we mark this day, we want to thank all Muslims and Arabs who support the Palestinian people, especially the axis of resistance.
People from all walks of life attending the rally called on all Palestinian factions to increase the resistance against the Israeli occupation to bring about the liberation of Al-Quds.
We will continue to support Hamas and the resistance until we liberate every inch of our land. We call on the Muslim nation to support Palestine and to support Al-Quds. People came out today to send a strong message of support to the resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Hamas supporters said they want the Israelis to know that the Islamic resistance movement is a force to be reckoned with. 35 years on, Hamas continues to garner support due to its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
People here say that despite years of siege and multiple wars, Hamas movement has managed to defy all odds and survive all attempts to weaken it. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now, postal workers in the UK go on a new wave of strikes as food and energy prices are taking a heavy toll on households. The Royal Mail workers walked out again over pay and work conditions just a few days after they staged another strike. Industrial action, which will also take place Thursday, has hit deliveries before Christmas. That action coincides with a strike by rail workers. And nurses are also scheduled to stage their first ever nationwide strike this week for the same reasons. Now, the opposition has slammed as a badge of shame for the government for its refusal to discuss a more generous potential pay offer that would have averted the nurses' strike. UK has been hit by a series of strikes as its inflation hit unprecedented rate of 11% and has fueled the cost of living crisis.
More picket lines and travel disruptions as tens of thousands of rail workers across Britain walk out. Represented by the RMT union, for months, they have been asking the government for better working conditions and an increase in their pay to match the double-digit inflation. The government says the pay rises are unaffordable and has promised tough action against the unions. The unions say they're standing firm.
This latest round of strikes will show how important our members are to the running of the country and will send a clear message that we want a good deal on job security, pay and conditions for our people. We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
The strikes come at a cost to the economy in terms of lost working days. And the right-wing media here have been counting that cost. Yet that doesn't seem to have dented public support for the strikers.
The cost of living has gone up, so if they need more money, then they should get a pay rise.
I can see where the rail workers are coming from. They want a pay rise. They're seeing their bills go up every month and they want to make sure they can support their families. At the same time, the government has a really tricky job on its hands to deal with inflation.
I support the strikes and things just because I feel like in certain sectors a lot of people deserve a pay rise anyway at the minute, especially with inflation. But us as travellers on holiday in London as such, obviously it's been a bit of an inconvenience to us.
The rail workers' walkout comes amid a cost-of-living crisis that's seen food and energy prices soar to 40-year highs since the start of the Ukraine war, pushing millions of Britons into poverty. Staff at the crisis-hit National Health Service will also be going on strike this week for the first time in more than 100 years. And the number of sectors joining the strike action is only growing.
We may not see a general strike in the traditional sense, but the way things are going, it is likely that the different trade unions will synchronize and coordinate their action to maximize their leverage for a better deal with the government. Saeed Pariza, London.
Russia says U.S. Patriot missile defense system to Ukraine will be a legitimate target for its strikes should Washington deliver them to Kiev. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov issued the warning after media reports quoted unnamed American officials as saying a plan is being finalized to send the missile systems to Ukraine. They say the decision could be announced as soon as this week. The Patriot is one of the most advanced air defense systems against aircraft and incoming missiles. U.S. has recently boosted its air defense support for Ukraine, citing a surge in Russian attacks. Washington has so far provided Ukraine with nearly $20 billion in military assistance since the beginning of the conflict.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, European countries have focused their attention on providing support to Kyiv, whether be it financially or militarily. However, Europe's increased concentration on Ukrainian refugees has diverted resources away from other refugee crises around the world. European countries are the largest donors of international aid. In recent years, European nations have been providing 50 billion euros per year to some underdeveloped countries that rely on foreign aid.
But since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the aid embarked for other countries was gradually cut and pumped into the war and the resulting crisis. The European Union has also agreed to add 2.1 billion euros to a fund severely depleted by the military aid for Ukraine in the war against Russia. The so-called European Peace Facility was set up last year to help the EU fund military assistance to its international partners. The fund's original budget of 5.7 billion euros was meant to last until 2027, but has almost completely run dry 10 months into the war in Ukraine. The EU and its member states have so far committed about 8 billion euros of military support to Ukraine against Russia. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 80% of the people in need of humanitarian aid live in 20 nations. The huge amount of money splurged on Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees has come at the expense of millions others in dire need of healthcare, education, and food across the globe. According to a new report, over 300 million people, half of them children, are in need of desperate aid in some of the world's poorest and most conflict-ridden regions. They have all been deprioritized following the war in Ukraine. For instance, while half of the Somalian population is facing famine, last year the African country was able to receive 68% of its requested funding after a year. Ukraine, though, received the same amount in a matter of 6 weeks. European countries have exhibited double standards regarding sheltering refugees from Ukraine and other nations, giving priority to the former. For example, Denmark holds a hard-nosed stand on Syrian immigrants, but reversed its strict asylum policy only to host Ukrainian refugees. Or in the UK, the government cut all non-essential aid back in 2020, reducing its official development assistance from 0.7% to 0.5%. The Center for Global Development says the reduced aid was spent on housing Ukrainians in the country.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Carrie Lake, the Trump-backed Republican candidate for governor of Arizona, has filed a lawsuit asking the court to throw out certified results of a loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. USA Today has covered the story and tells us more. Former candidate for governor Carrie Lake on Friday, 9th of December, filed a lawsuit asking the courts to set aside her electoral loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs and declare her the winner instead. If a judge won't declare her the winner, Carrie Lake wants an order requiring Maricopa County to redo the gubernatorial election. Carrie Lake, a former television news anchor and first-time candidate for office, has signaled for weeks that she would file a legal challenge over the election, which saw her fall 0.7 percentage points, or about 17,000 votes, short of her rival, Katie Hobbs, who is Arizona's Secretary of State. The filing came on Friday, 9th of December, within a five-day window from certification of the election result that is set in Arizona law, and on the same day that several defeated Republican candidates filed their own challengers. Republican Secretary of State candidate Mark Fincham and U.S. House candidate Jeff Zink contested their losses, saying Arizona's election was not full, fair or secure and must be nullified. A process that should be sacrosanct oozes impropriety, they said in a joint statement of election contest filed in Maricopa County Superior Court. Our election is the only midterm election in the 50 states with such a comical and tragic outcome. Republican Abe Hamadeh, who was defeated by Democrat Chris Mays in the race for Attorney General by about 500 votes, also filed a lawsuit that stood in stark contrast to the others, in that it explicitly did not allege fraud or intentional wrongdoing, but sought to eliminate or add votes Hamadeh claims were improperly counted. The race is headed for a recount. Kerry Lake's 70-page lawsuit includes a laundry list of problems and allegations related to the 8th of November midterm elections, including echoing many claims she has raised in recent weeks over long lines and printer issues created chaos at voting locations. She claims hundreds of thousands of illegal ballots infected the election in Maricopa County, Arizona. The lawsuit also references issues that were raised and repeatedly debunked in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential contest and the subsequent Arizona Senate review of the Maricopa County election. Aides to Katie Hobbs, who has begun hiring staff to serve her in the governor's office, couched Kerry Lake's far-reaching lawsuit as a nuisance and a sham. Kerry Lake needs attention like a fish needs water, a statement from Katie Hobbs' campaign manager, Nicole DeMont, reads. And independent experts and local election officials for both parties have made clear that this was a safe, secure and fair election. Arizonans made their voices heard, the statement continued. Katie Hobbs is slated to take office on 2nd of January 2023. Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. Kerry Lake, the Republican defeated in Arizona's governor's race, is formally challenging her loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs, asking a court to throw out certified election results from the state's most populous county and either declare her the winner or rerun the governor's election in that county. The lawsuit, filed late on Friday, 9th of December, by Kerry Lake, centers on long lines and other difficulties that people experienced while voting on Election Day in Maricopa County, Arizona. The challenge filed in Maricopa County's Superior Court also alleges hundreds of thousands of ballots were illegally cast, but there is no evidence that this is true. Kerry Lake has refused to acknowledge that she lost to Katie Hobbs by more than 17,000 votes. The Donald Trump-endorsed gubernatorial candidate has bombarded Maricopa County with complaints, largely relating to a problem with printers at some voter centers that led to ballots being printed with markings that were too light to be read by the on-site tabulators. Lines backed up in some polling places, fueling Republican suspicions that some supporters were unable to cast a ballot, though there is no evidence it affected the outcome. County officials say everyone was able to vote and all legal ballots were counted. Kerry Lake sued Maricopa County officials and Katie Hobbs in her current role as Arizona's Secretary of State. Sophia Solis, a spokesperson for the Secretary of State's office, said Kerry Lake's lawsuit was being reviewed but had no other comment on the filing. Jason Berry, a Maricopa County spokesperson, declined to comment on Kerry Lake's request to throw out the county's election results in the governor's race. But he said the county respects the election contest process and looks forward to sharing facts about the administration of the 2022 general election and our work to ensure every legal voter had an opportunity to cast their ballot. Katie Hobbs is in a post on her Twitter account called the lawsuit Lake's latest desperate attempt to undermine our democracy and throw out the will of the voters. She posted a statement from her campaign manager that called the lawsuit a sham and said her camp remained focused on getting ready to hit the ground running on day one of Katie Hobbs' administration. Carrie Lake's lawsuit says Republicans were disproportionately affected by the problems in Maricopa County because they outvoted Democrats on election day 3-1. GOP leaders have urged their voters to wait until election day to vote. In late November, Carrie Lake filed a public records lawsuit demanding Maricopa County hand over documents relating to the election. She was seeking to identify voters who may have had trouble casting a ballot, such as people who checked in at more than one vote center or those who returned a mail ballot and also checked in at a polling place. During the summer, a federal judge also rejected a request by Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham, the defeated Republican candidate for Secretary of State, to require hand counting of all ballots during the November midterm elections. The judge has since sanctioned lawyers representing Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham, saying they made false, misleading and unsupported factual assertions in their lawsuit. The lawyers told the court that their claims were legally sound and supported by strong evidence. Katie Hobbs, in her role as Secretary of State in Arizona, has petitioned the court to begin an automatic statewide recount required by law in three races decided by less than half a percentage point. The race for Attorney General was one of the closest contests in state history, with Democrat Chris Mays leading Republican candidate Abe Hamada by just 510 votes out of a total votes of 2.5 million.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us begin the day by pondering on a mind-stimulating aphorism from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Knowledge is a venerable estate. Good manners are new dresses. And thinking is clear mirror.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, following the prophets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that the Quran is the book of guidance, and Allah has sent the book of guidance in the shape of Quran, and He has mentioned the stories of the prophets. And these stories are for the guidance of the mankind. If someone wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must follow the guidance that is being given by the Quran. Therefore, when we look at the life of the prophets, in order to get some guidance from there, for example, in the life of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, we see that the Prophet Musa alayhi salam was the one who stood against the oppression of his time. Bani Israel, who was under the pressure and the oppression of the Pharaoh, and they couldn't go anywhere where the Pharaoh was killing their kids. He was killing the generations. He had them under the oppression. He came as a Messiah and he saved them. He was the savior of the Bani Israel of that time. And therefore, it shows us that if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, we cannot live by closing our lips and not talking not talking against the oppression. If we are silent, we are not raising our voice against the oppression, then obviously the same thing that has happened to Bani Israel at the time of Pharaoh will happen to us. And this can only be done in order to have a good lifestyle. It can only be done if we follow the footsteps of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, the way he raised his voice against the oppression, the way he came in front of the Pharaoh. And today even we see that the oppression that is going around the world, how the oppression is happening. And those who are silent, they are having more oppression. But those who raise their voice, they are living a free life. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We gave the example of the Prophet Moses alayhi salam, how he stood against the oppression and how he was acknowledged, or he knew about the time where he was living, about the things that were happening in his time. And we see that Prophet Moses, with all knowledge, has come against the oppression. And that is the duty of every single Muslim. If they want to have the Islamic lifestyle, they must be aware of what is happening around the world, the oppression that is happening. For example, we can see people in Yemen, we can see oppression in Yemen, in Palestine, we can see oppression in the West or East. There is many discriminations that are happening, many things that are against the Islamic teachings. We can see, for example, you know, the movement of LGTB, this is against the beliefs that we have. This is against the beliefs that the Prophet Moses had. Obviously, Prophet Lut was at the time of the Prophet Moses, and they were living at the same time. So the prophets in the Quran, they stood against these types of theories or thoughts. Why? Because these things are not taking us towards the perfection. The goal is to go towards the fitrah. The goal is to reach to the perfection. And the only place, only time when we can reach to perfection, or we can travel towards the perfection, is when we are aware of everything, what is right and what is wrong. And we are raising our voice against the wrong things. We should not be amongst the wrongdoers. If today the world, the secular world, or the world who is against even God, if they are having the movements against the teachings of the religion, against the teachings of Allah, for example, in the shape of LGBT movement, I don't know, in the shape of feminism, in any shape, if they are a Muslim, if he wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must aware his kids of these frauds, these things that are happening, these wrong, we can say, beliefs, and we need to save our children, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationships between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, 8 cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month, and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region, as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the gray green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyya is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day, since the menu largely includes local flavors. A young British artist has found an incredible way to create art using not pen or paper, but typewriter. Symbols and letters are turned into complex drawings by this 25-year-old's adept fingers, gaining him attention online. London-based James Cork, who studied architecture, used to draw portraits. But that all changed when he discovered his now signature tool, the typewriter, in 2014. He says the idea came to his mind when he came across Paul Smith, an artist from the 1920s, who produced similar work. Initially, Cook thought it impossible, but he gave it a try. Now, after 8 years, he can draw complex images from Hollywood star Tom Hanks to the London Eye or the Millennium Bell. But while his works appear flawless to viewers, Cook says it never gets any easier and that it's always a challenge for him.
There's something really satisfying about kind of using this sort of limited palette of... You basically have about 44 keys on a typewriter on average. So you've got to kind of puzzle piece those letters, numbers, punctuation marks together to make a drawing.
Recently, online interest has encouraged Cook to pursue his passion. People donate their typewriters to Cook, who gives these machines a second life. He now has a collection of more than 40 typewriters dating from the early 20s.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to two more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there are really many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warn that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil. In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle has also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail, the poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists continue to raise alarm about the intertwined climate and biodiversity crises, warning that Western countries are losing the ability to lead as they break climate commitments. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, talking in high profile while dragging their feet, such contradictory actions are not sustainable when it comes to dealing with climate change. Only reasonable deeds can be pushed forward in a sustainable way, and only countries with the ability to lead can set an example as pioneers. Unfortunately, the West is losing such ability. According to a Guardian report, the UK will build its first new coal mine in 3 decades at Whitehaven in Cumbria, northwest England. The new mine will take 2 years to build and will produce an estimated 2.8 tons of coking coal a year, which is used in the production of steel. Burning a pound of coal emits 2.7 pounds of carbon dioxide. The UK government seems to be forgetting about the climate commitments it has made in the past. At last year's COP26 climate change conference in the UK's Glasgow, the UK set the goal of accelerating the phase out of coal. In 2019, it committed to reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said in his speech at this year's COP27 last month that Britain is morally right to honour its climate change commitments. In June, the UK's climate change watchdog warned that the plan to build a coal mine in Cumbria is absolutely indefensible because the resulting pollution would blow holes through the nation's pledge to reduce emissions by 2050. In similar moves, France has rebooted a coal-fired power station to secure the country's electricity supply over the winter. A hard coal-fired power plant in Germany is also back in operation due to the gas supply crisis. While in the US, the Supreme Court ruled in July to limit the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to resist and restrict greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, a significant setback for climate action. Against the backdrop of the Russia-Ukraine crisis, Western countries broke the energy supply-demand balance with Russia, not only dragging themselves into an energy crisis, but also pulling the whole world to bear the consequences. When these old-brand capitalist countries put their narrow interest above the country's long-term interest and the common interest of humanity, this overshadows the efforts in coping with climate change by the world, especially developing countries. Climate change is one of the most important agendas facing humanity. It requires the cooperation of all countries and should transcend geopolitics. But the experiences in the past decades show that, in Western countries, climate change actions are subject to their foreign political and economic objectives. This means the West will only talk high, but act low, and be strict with others while loose with itself. This is what hypocrisy entails. For a long time, Western countries have used climate change and carbon emissions as political tools. Behind the climate agenda is a set of geopolitical tools crafted by Western countries to suppress developing countries. They label themselves as a pioneer in coping with climate change, while using climate change as an excuse to block development of developing countries so that they can't continue to enjoy the benefits they once exploited. Be bossy as always and retain their discourse power and dominant position in the international system. The West has not paid back historical debts and now it is owing more. Shen Yi, a professor from Fudan University, told the Global Times that Western countries took the lead in completing industrialization while emitting carbon dioxide recklessly, and they have an obligation to help developing countries reduce carbon emissions. However, Western regimes not only transferred their industries to developing countries to enjoy the high quality and cheap products from developing countries, but at the same time required developing countries to pay for carbon emissions. This is sacrificing some people's interest to realize others' governance model. For the West, emission reduction is not a rigid task, and it is just normal to sacrifice long-term goals for current political objectives. Xiu Liang, an associate professor at the School of International Relations of Beijing International Studies University, believes that Western regimes such as the UK should explain and apologize to the international community because they delay the global process of tackling climate change. But the question is, do these countries have the will to bear international responsibilities? For them, international responsibility is just a false proposition. Meanwhile, the website of Common Dreams noted, with a global biodiversity summit underway in Montreal, Guardian columnist George Monbiot recently took aim at the U.S. for its active and deadly cavalier attitude toward the rest of the world. An example, other nations follow. Although U.S. President Joe Biden recently appointed Monica Medina as the first special envoy for biodiversity and water resources, and his administration is participating in the 15th Conference of the Parties, COP15 of the Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD, the U.S. is notably not a party to the treaty, which was drafted in 1992. In fact, the U.S. is the only United Nations member state not to ratify the treaty. The other 192 UN countries, the European Union, Cook Islands, New and Palestine are also parties to the CBD, leaving the U.S. in the company of just the Holy See, the government of the Roman Catholic Church.